Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up over the next half hour, Vatican cyberspace. The what's, who's, and where's it going of the Holy See's website. And respecting relics. I take a look at why relics hold a respected place in the church. Pope Benedict has urged the church to take advantage of new ways of communicating to spread the gospel. But he also says the church has an obligation to point out areas where the media has a harmful effect, especially on children. Well, when we think of new methods of communication, the internet immediately comes to mind. Without a doubt, the advent of the World Wide Web has had a profound effect on almost every aspect of our lives. It's not only changed the way we communicate, but also the way we do business, retrieve information, and even educate ourselves. And the Catholic Church is no exception. The Holy See's Internet Office strives to keep abreast of this fast-changing world and is actively exploring strategies for using this new technology to communicate the gospel message. The results in cyberspace at www.vatican.va. Susie Hodges tells us more.
The Holy See's internet site was launched without fanfare in 1995. It began with one web page containing a single document, the Pope's Christmas message for that year. But the site expanded rapidly and now contains a storehouse of information, not just for the faithful, but for art lovers, historians, tourists, and the merely curious. Nowadays, it typically gets over 1 million unique visitors a month, but that number increased dramatically during the papal transition period in the spring of 2005. Sister Judith Zobelin works at the Holy See's Internet Office and was one of those who helped set up the site. She identified the internet's potential shortly after it exploded on the scene in the mid-1990s, and together with a group of colleagues, she took the idea of launching a website to Pope John Paul, who quickly gave them the go-ahead. Sister Judith believes the Church must expand its presence on the internet, and she spoke about the thinking and mission behind the Holy See's site and about some of their latest projects.
Well, I think there, on the part of the Holy See and any Catholic organization around the world, there's great interest in internet because, for two reasons, I think. One, it's an enormous means of evangelizing and communicating among church organizations and to people who may not know much about what the church says or teaches. In fact, one of the things we've seen with our search engine is when there's any major event in the world, terrorism, war, you know, the tsunami, you name it, when there's something that stirs the heart of the global village, they come to the Vatican site to figure out what did the Holy Father say about it. I mean, the Holy Father, as we know well, is an incredibly strong moral voice that many in the world listen to and want to know what he says, even if they don't agree with him. So internet has become the way that people really are able to find out what he said when something breaks, big news or crisis or something like that. So I think there's great interest on the part of the Holy See in seeing what we can use internet for and how we need to use it. Now, keep in mind that our internet office is both an information provider, which is what we've been talking about so far, getting the documents out, letting people search, you know, on the documents along those lines. But we are also the service provider for the Vatican community. So we have lots to do with that, you know, just the email exchange and how we're going to do that, the sort of what we call in the business back-end use where you might, you know, the different dicasteries are working on their little sub-pages on the site and other exchange of information that would be intra the Vatican. So there's a lot happening along those lines as well.
One of the most striking features about the internet is the way it crosses all boundaries and is truly global. And the same is true of the Holy See's website, as Sister Judith goes on to explain.
I think internet, if you just look at our site, it requires 6 different languages. So you're always bending your mind around a culture and a language in order to take the same document or the same graphics or the same symbols that you're presenting on the site and kind of seeing how that will be perceived by a different culture and a different language. So there's always, it's more like a consciousness of being intercultural at this point. Also through the internet, for example, on our search engine, we have feedback from people from about 120 different countries every single month. And you know that what you're doing out there is reaching people and that you're touching them with the whole message of the Holy Father and the Magisterium. And that message is getting somehow enculturated in some form or the other in each one of those 120 countries.
As the Holy See's website has expanded in scope, Sister Judith says so has her job description.
Well, the office has grown to a certain size and I think also you might say mission in terms of the use of internet, so that we now have a capo ufficio, or a department head, Padre Fernando Vergez, who really manages the people and the site and also makes that interface with the rest of the Vatican organizations. My work then has become more to work on new projects, to try to see how we can reapply the internet in some new ways, and you might call it research and development. Some of the ideas go forward, some of them don't. Some of them take time to work on and realize. But it's very interesting. It's allowed you to really look at the possibilities of internet in a lot of different situations and to interface with people, again, all around the world who are also doing some new things and see if these things are appropriate for our site of the Holy See and, you know, maybe try to do a little test project with it and see what other people might say who need to decide what the Holy See will do with internet.
One of the new projects Sister Judith is currently involved in is the running of a trial e-learning site, and she explains why they embarked on this move.
Right now we're working on some e-learning, trying to take some of the papal documents and make them, particularly for young people, and I say young, maybe 20 to 35 years old, young adults who are living for the first time on their own, trying to live their faith, make it a place where they can come, learn something about their faith, and hopefully work within a local church situation. That's the idea of it. You learn on the internet, you exchange on the internet, but then that should bring you back to a local community, because community can't just happen on the internet. It has to be, particularly in the church, in some kind of an actual situation. It has to be a parish or a university system or young adults in the diocese or something. So we're trying that. We're testing it in a number of places in the world. We're testing it with a number of different kinds of group. Not that we'll become a learning center at the Vatican, but that we can begin to test some ideas and learn who else is doing it and interact with each other, feed each other, see how our little piece, which not little, but our piece would be anything to do with the papal magisterial documents. How can we assist, help other people to utilize those in something they might do, and then also trying it ourselves. So it's not public. It's in what we call beta form, which means we've asked particular people to help test it. And so therefore, as it will always be, you have to have an ID and password to get in. And we were trying to see through some local groups that we know already in the local church, parishes, like I said, universities, there was a Catholic hospital that did it, religious communities are trying it to see if it's a mode that will help enrich their situation as a Catholic local situation.
The internet offers many opportunities to evangelize because, as Sister Judith points out, the majority of those who log on to the Holy See's site are not necessarily Catholic.
The great thing about internet is you're reaching a body of people who are unchurched for the most part. You have many people who don't, you know, particularly have a religion or weren't raised in a religion or don't really care. But they get on the internet and there's a drawing into the symbolism, into the visual, into some of the information or the personalities that are like the Holy Father that can easily be touched, if you will, through the internet. So I think people are fascinated. You call it curiosity or call it that inner nature of man seeking the sacred and finding it in a ritual of a Mass.
When it comes to the Holy See's website, it's no surprise to learn that the focus of people's attentions when they log on is the Pope. Sister Judith again.
Yeah, without a doubt, it's the Holy Father. And there's no question that people come to the site to really, I think, see the documents, to hear what he has to say, to catch the news, things along those lines. Video, we're starting to do a video archive. That's starting to get some... The problem is it's always in Italian, so you know, most of the people on internet probably speak either Spanish or English or even French. I think they're much more international languages. But people want visual on internet, so we're trying to do that vis-a-vis the graphics and some of the video offerings of the different celebrations and important things that the Holy Father does. But by and large, people come to find out what the Holy Father has to say. And then, of course, there are other major documents that come out of the different dicasteries, which are also important. I think one of the heaviest traffic times before the death of the Holy Father was when they released the document on Fatima. People just couldn't wait to get online and find out what was going on with that whole prediction of Sister Lucia. So there is interest in what the Church has to say.
Whilst the internet provides many advantages in terms of the speed and ease for communicating on a global level, it also has numerous dangers, especially for the young who spend so much time on the net. Sister Judith believes one of the key challenges for the Church when it comes to the internet is to help ensure that young people don't fall into the trap of living their faith virtually, instead of connecting to a real community in a parish.
Yeah, I think I'm always on the net, looking at what people are doing and, you know, trying to figure out, if you will, some sort of trends or even to look at some things and see where people are getting trapped in internet. The whole idea of, you know, in the past 10 years, one of the biggest changes caused by internet or enabled, let's say, by internet has been the capacity, particularly for young people, to live virtually and not actually. And so, to me, that's an enormous danger. 10 years ago, when people were writing the Holy Father, they were writing him because they felt connected to him by their local parish, their priest, the social community they had vis-a-vis the Church there. Now, you don't have that as much, particularly with young people. You have them meeting on the net, sharing on the net. You have things like Facebook and MySpace and Flickr, and they talk to each other that way. And so they don't have that... if you will, body base in a local community. So to me, there's been that enormous shift where people can think that they're living because they're living on the internet. Then you go going beyond that where you can, I don't know if you know the terminology, first life and second life. I encountered it about a few months ago when I was talking to a group of techies. But first life is your actual life. Second life is the life that you live on the internet. And so the life that you live on the internet sometimes eclipses your actual life. And so people will even, you know, as we know in gaming, they'll invent personalities. You can be a completely different person than you are now. And you go on living your life in sort of this major persona, which is not you. People who have an actual life that has some substance to it are not perhaps in danger as much as young people who are trying to discover who they are and are very confused, can be confused by some virtual reality they created about themselves. So I do spend the time looking at a lot of different sites and trying to figure out what's happening and where to meet people so that the faith is really a presence for them and that they can turn to.
That was Sister Judith Zobelin of the Holy See's Internet Office. And I'm Susie Hodges.
Well, you'll find the Holy See's website at www.vatican.va. And besides finding the latest information about the Pope, his writings, and his activities, you'll also see links here to the Vatican Secret Archives, the Vatican Library and Museums, the Vatican Printing House, the liturgical calendar, and information on recently canonized saints. Again, the address is vatican.va. When my dad died, it took my family more than a year to go through his closets and drawers, to sift through decades of life and love, for memories to cherish and clothes to give away to people less fortunate than we. It was the little things we each saved the cufflinks, the books, a lock of hair, a silk tie that kept Dad close to us even after his passing. The little things that tie our frenetic lives to his, the best memories to savor and to pass on to our own children. Saving an object that belonged to someone close to us seems to come naturally to most of us. In fact, it is very likely that the first Christians kept the very first relics to, in some way, keep alive the memory of Christ and his saints. Since the very beginning, Christians have venerated relics of all shape and form, pieces of wood from the true cross, the body of a past pope, the finger of the doubting St. Thomas, the blood-stained bandage of Padre Pio, or the skull of St. Catherine, just to name a few. Relics obviously don't possess magic powers, but the Church does see them as a way the faithful can come closer to a person who was deemed holy, and they can help us form a closer bond with God. But why do relics fascinate Catholics and non-Catholics alike? Or is the veneration of relics simply a macabre superstition? Well, my colleague Susie Hodges spoke to Elizabeth Lev, an expert on Christian art and archaeology, about what constitutes a relic and how the Church has viewed them over the centuries.
A relic is an object which can be a part of a body or clothing or something that belonged to a saint, which is someone that the Church recognizes as being in heaven. Therefore, while their souls are in heaven, this object remains on earth as something that we can remember our tie between the earthly matter and the saint's soul in heaven.
Do we have any idea when the practice of venerating relics first began?
Well, the practice of venerating relics is an extremely, extremely old practice. It goes all the way back. We have a very well-documented case of St. Polycarp, whose body ashes were gathered together, and they were, as the people of Smyrna said, they were treasured more than precious stones. So the idea of the body of a martyr being something to preserve, to venerate, to take care of, is a very old tradition indeed, 2nd century AD.
But it's not just bodies, is it? I mean, for instance, Christ's cross very quickly became an object of veneration and, according to legend, was broken up, wasn't it?
Yes, it doesn't have to merely be the body of a martyr. It can be an object that belonged to a martyr, but particularly the relics of Christ's passion have been extremely precious. The cross of Christ, of the crucifixion, was found by St. Helen in the early 4th century AD. By 354 AD, we know that the cross had already been broken up and sent across the empire because everybody wanted to have a piece, a part of this memory of Christ's salvific sacrifice.
Coming back, though, to the saints, it's true that at first the Christians, they venerated the saints, but they never actually dismembered the bodies. And yet afterwards, they did start to do that. Why? Do you know?
Actually, it's a funny little break between the East and the West on this one. We have an understanding in the 6th century AD in the western part of the empire, in Rome, a request for part of the body of St. Peter, which Gregory the Great answers by saying that we do not follow the custom of breaking up the bodies. In Rome, the custom was to lie a piece of cloth on the grave of a martyr, which would then be given or cut up or given to the faithful. Instead, in the East, the custom of breaking up the bodies, the custom of the body parts, is very, very old and very well rooted.
And at some point then they decided to follow the Eastern example.
Well, a lot of it has to do with the intermixing between the East and the West, particularly during the iconoclasm controversy, when the Eastern Church began to mix more with the Western Church. There was a series of Greek popes. I mean, there's a lot of intermixing which changed the custom. Also, similar to the fragment of the True Cross, it became also a question of ensuring that many different churches could have the relic of an apostle or someone extremely venerated throughout the universal church.
I know it must be difficult to pinpoint this, but can you think of some of the most famous or fascinating relics that we've had throughout history or even that survive to the present day?
Well, some of them, the interesting relics divide up into two categories. There is a category of relics that are very moving and still to this day very powerful. The thorn from the crown of thorns, the relic of the true cross, as I want to say in the Church of the Holy Cross, it's the finger of St. Thomas that always catches my eye. The remains of certain saints, they're beautiful reliquaries with the heads of the four sainted Leos. So you have all four of the great Pope Leos in one reliquary. But then there's another class of relic, which are the completely specious, a little bit over the edge, crazy relics, which really come from an era of what could best be described as relic mongering, when everybody was so hungry for relics that they came up with all sorts of insane objects. Some of the darkness from the plague of Egypt apparently is bottled and kept in the Church of St. Mark here. Or you could have some of the breast milk of the Virgin. I mean, there were quite a few relics that
very inventive
are
people.
Very, very, very inventive. But that's when you know the relic situation has got out of hand.
But that was, as you say, back in the Middle Ages. Did it then afterwards sort of calm down a bit as perhaps people became a bit more better educated?
Church has had to, if you will, crack down on several occasions, and going all the way back to St. Augustine. St. Augustine already warns about false relic mongers, people who dress up as monks and sell false relics. There are problems. There's another letter of a group of Easterners who came and dug up a bunch of bodies with the intention of bringing them back to the East, and here we're talking about the 6th century AD. So there's been a continuous ebb and flow of relic sales, relic fraud, and the church would crack down on them, particularly in the Councils of Trent, when the situation really was brought under control in the reforming councils. The Councils of Trent simply forbade any sale of relics, so there was no lucre attached to it.
But what's the church's official position on relics in the present day?
Well, the church's, it's the same position as it was at the time of the Councils of Trent. The relics are there to be venerated. We are not to attach any kind of magical powers to them, because it's not the relic itself that contains some kind of magic. It is God's ability to do grace, to give grace through the object of someone who is very dear to him, a saint. And therefore, the church suggests or allows us to venerate relics, allows us to see relics as a kind of portal to God's grace, but to not ever attribute it to the matter, but to the supernatural, to the divine behind it.
Now, when it comes to Rome, of course, as the home of the Catholic Church, there must be a lot of famous relics scattered about the city. Can you tell us about some of them?
Rome has an astonishing quantity of relics, and the first collection of relics, the greatest collection of relics, was in the Palace of St. John Lateran. There was the Sancta Sanctorum, which is known at the top of the Holy Stairs today, and it was a private chapel where only the Pope went, which had the most remarkable catalog of the saints, relics of the saints, various objects. The catalog was so precious, it was actually written in mosaic. It still exists, and the catalog is written in mosaic form. At the same time, the relics that are most precious to Rome are the bodies of St. Peter and St. Paul, which for centuries, millennia now, people have come to venerate and remember St. Peter and St. Paul, who both died on the soil, and thanks to them, the Church of Rome was founded. There's another great collection of relics, which is in the Pantheon. One of those things that people don't know so much about, because the Pantheon is always, it's a pagan building. It was constructed as a pagan building. It was turned into a church in 609, but it became St. Mary of the Martyrs, because when the catacombs were emptied in the 7th and 8th century, the bodies were brought to the Pantheon. And on certain feast days, an incredible array of reliquaries can be brought out into the altar of the Pantheon. And so you see in this amazing building. Well, it's particularly Pentecost. The Pentecost is the greatest feast day for the Pantheon. It's the day that they drop the red rose petals in through the oculus. That's the greatest day of the year. But on other feast days, or even on a special mass, they'll bring out some of the reliquaries. But to see the altar arrayed at Pentecost is remarkable.
Now, many modern Christians, particularly from Western countries, you know, do tend now to consider them a rather macabre superstition relics. I mean, do you think the number of those who are rather sceptical about them is growing?
Well, I think in our day and age, we have become far more sceptical. Although I would like to say that plenty of people were sceptical in the Middle Ages, plenty of people were sceptical in the Renaissance. Skepticism is not something that the 21st century has a monopoly on. But we seem to have closed ourselves off to that particular form of supernatural. And it has a lot to do with ignorance, with not understanding exactly what the function of a relic is, and a lot to do with just not much information about them. Very few people really understand what a relic is, what it means to have the body of a pope under the altar at St. Peter's. And surprisingly enough, the catechism itself doesn't give a lot of orientation. It actually barely mentions relics at all. So it is a kind of, people have become distanced from what is an age-old custom in the church of venerating, remembering, wanting to be close to people who lived on this earth just like them, but have succeeded in making it to heaven.
Nonetheless, despite, as you say, there may be these growing sceptics, there are an awful lot of other people who are still fascinated by them. There was a recent exhibition, wasn't there, of a bloody segment of bandage belonging to Padre Pio. So how do you explain this continuing fascination, at least on the part of some of the faithful?
The remnant of the bandage of Padre Pio coming to Rome was a big wake-up call, I think, for a lot of people. They planned a little procession, maybe, you know, a few people from the parish would come. The place was packed. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people came to see the relic of Padre Pio. When the body of St. Augustine was brought from Pavia down to Rome to be near his mother, hundreds of people came. And so it tells us that, you know, it seems to indicate, let's say, that we are looking for that evidence of the supernatural. We're looking for, we still want it. It's that we're sort of shamed into having to take a more sophisticated, cosmopolitan, cynical, or skeptical approach, when indeed I think all of us in one way or another hunger to know that there's something greater out there, that there is some sort of contact, there's some recognition of the divine beyond our mundane daily lives.
Thanks there to Elizabeth Lev, a professor of Christian art and archaeology at Duquesne University's Rome campus. She was speaking there to my colleague, Susie Hodges. That concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.